Once the asteroid has been diverted,
that may be hours from now.
In that case, everyone on this planet will die, including the captain.
Lock all phasers on that mark.
You lost for us, you lost for that planet, you lost for Jim.
We are your people. We've been waiting for you to come to us.
I say he must prove he is a god.
Many things are strange to me.
Miramani, come here.
I bear your child.
I cannot permit this joining.
You are a god.
Fire,
there's the false one.
No!
Do you, Chris, take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? Do you promise to barrage her with obscure facts concerning comics, movies, TV shows, and toys?
I do.
And Cindy, do you take this man-child to be your lawfully wedded husband? Do you promise to humor him by engaging him in his obsessive ramblings, for better or worse, in pre-crisis or in post?
Sure, why not?
Then by the power invested in me by the High Father of the Fourth World, I now pronounce you Supermates. You may podcast with the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 47 of Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Cindy.
And today we can announce that we are now a proud member of the Fire and Water Network.
Woo!
Yay! So actually you'll be hearing a promo for that shortly. But that means that the show is now officially part of the what used to be the Fire and Water family of podcasts, which is now a full-blown network of podcasts, which only makes sense since this show wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Rob asking me to be on the Power Records episode of Fire and Water, which eventually became the Power Records podcast. So there. So more details are forthcoming. There'll be some new ways to, there'll be a new Facebook page and things like that where all the shows will be there that are a part of the Firewater Network. There'll be a new web page. There'll be, you can download all the shows. You can subscribe to all the shows or just whichever shows you want, that type of thing. But more details forthcoming, but just wanted to get it out there because Rob, by the time this episode drops, Rob and Shag will have already officially announced it anyway. So why don't we just run that promo right now? Here you go.
Yeah, I'm really excited for 2016. In fact, I think we should record a promo about all the changes to the Fire and Water Podcast Network happening this year. What do you think, Rob?
That's a great idea. We can mention the new folks joining the network and all the shows. I can talk about how we'll continue with our Aquaman and Firestorm show, and I want to be sure to plug my movie show, the Film and Water Podcast. What about you, Ryan?
Oh, I think we should definitely record a promo. I'll mention how the Secret Origins podcast is joining the Fire and Water Network, and then I'll introduce my newly relaunched shows, Give Me Those Star Wars and Power of Fishnets, the Black Canary and Zatanna podcast. Sound good to you, Chris?
Absolutely. I'll mention the show I record with my lovely wife, Cindy, Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geekcast. We should probably also mention the Power Records podcast Rob and I do, too. What about you, Siskoid?
Well, sure. I can talk about my ensemble show, the Lonely Hearts Romance Comics podcast, and my new upcoming shows about the DC Comics crossover event, Invasion, and yes, Oh Hot Moo. Shag, you think we should mention Hero Points, the most occasional DC Heroes role-playing podcast?
Sure, why not? And I can talk about Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe, and mention my new upcoming show, Justice League International, Wahaha podcast. Now, here's what I'm thinking. When we record, I'm fine being the first person talking. I can explain all the changes to the
Wait a minute. Why do you get to start the promo? I'm just as much of a part of this as you are. It was my idea to create the Fire and Water podcast back in 2011. I should start off this promo.
I kind of think it should be one of the new voices who kick off the promo. It'll shock the listener into attention if it's not Rob or Shag.
Cindy and I make up two people in the network, plus, you know, ladies first, so we should be the first people talking on the promo.
Ben voyons donc.
You have what? God.
Enough.
Stop it. You're like boys with toys.
Let's just make this simple. We can tell the folks at home the Fire and Water Podcast Network is growing in 2016. Several new shows are joining the network. We'll have a new dedicated website, a Twitter account, and Facebook page, and folks will be able to subscribe to each individual show or all of them. See, now was that so hard?
The Fire and Water Podcast Network, available soon through iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Seriously, Shag, you had to get the last word, didn't you?
While we're on the subject of Fire and Water, I was on a episode of the Film and Water podcast that's part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, where Rob, Shag, Ryan Daly, and I discussed The Force Awakens. And, you know, at this point, since this is the first episode we've recorded since the new year, The question is, how many times have you seen The Force Awakens? Not if you've seen it, but how many times have you seen it? You and Danny have seen it twice.
Mm-hmm. And me we've seen it as a family of four. Then you and Andrew saw it, yeah. And then we went and saw it as a family of four again.
Yeah. So, and the first time we had a couple of Andrew's buddies with us too.
Yeah.
So, me and Andrew have seen it three times. You and Danny have seen it twice.
Mm-hmm.
So did you want to weigh in on it or anything while we were...
Oh, I'm pretty sure Danny's probably going to go as Rey for Halloween.
Yeah.
So if that tells you anything. So.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, not a whole lot to add. Just that, you know, we really enjoyed it. You know, I mean, everybody's entitled their opinion, and I don't begrudge anyone who didn't like it, but I think...
I do, well, dumbasses.
Well... Well, I think people that don't, I mean, I shouldn't say this. It sounds like an absolute and, you know, only cis speak in absolutes, which, you know, is an absolute statement, which doesn't make any sense. But I think the complaints I've read of fans are like people who are going in wanting to dislike it. It's like they're just resistant to liking it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, or they're just nitpicking it to death. And it's like, just enjoy it. Just have fun with it. And I mean, it's not perfect. I mean, I even complained that, you know, the Death Star thing again, really? I mean, to me, that was almost a bridge too far. But that's not the part of the story you care about. So I could deal with it. But, you know, I just don't get the, you know, and of course... You know, they can scream in the wind all they want. The movie's making billions and billions of dollars.
Right.
You know, I know there's people griping about this and griping about that. And so many people are trying to tax stupid, you know, gender politics and bullshit on it. It's a freaking movie, people. It's a freaking science fantasy movie that's fun. It's meant to be fun. You know, it's great that they give you a female hero that kicks butt. And, you know, and they give you, you know, they give you some diversity. There's another hero that's, you know, the black. So that's great. I mean, there's diversity there. Anybody that's complaining about that, they're doing a good thing here, mm-hmm. you know, by giving you some, making your main characters not pasty white people, you
right,
know,
right.
white pasty white guys, you know. So quit griping, you know.
I will say this about it.
What?
I mean, this is not a spoiler, you know, at all.
Spoiler warning! Cindy actually does spoil the living crap out of The Force Awakens. If you're the one person who hasn't seen the movie yet, you might want to forward this episode a few minutes in, okay? Back to the recorded show already in progress.
But think about this. Leia.
Mm-hmm.
She, you know, her parents both die. Mm-hmm. Well, her mother dies. Mm-hmm. Her father turns to the dark side.
Mm-hmm.
She's raised by her adoptive family. Her adoptive family's killed. Her planet's killed. Her son turns to the dark side. Her lover gets killed by her son.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't turn to the dark side. Never thinks of it. Skywalker man gotta step it up, not be sissy bitches.
I will say that was very spoilerific, actually. But I will agree with you. You're right. Yeah.
I mean,
good point.
You know.
You know, she ain't, you know, all raging and, you know, turning to... Yeah, good point. And she's got the Force, too. You know, obviously, she's Force sensitive. You know,
yeah.
I don't know how well she's got it, but she's Force sensitive, obviously.
Uh-huh.
You know, so good point. Yeah, that's... That's one thing I hadn't thought of, but yeah. Well, I think that's a good place to leave off with Star Wars. In amongst all the, you know, holiday hoopla, which we had, you know, nice, you know, holiday time and Christmas and everything. But we've also, shortly after Christmas, our house got torn up.
Well, first, on Christmas Eve night, our car quit, and we ended up having to have it towed, and we were down to one car for about a week and a half because the whole computer went out.
Yeah.
And then we have a water leak in our kitchen, which is fabulous, and we're living out of totes kitchen-wise. So
yeah, and we've...
stellar.
Yeah, there's been a lot of just, you know, life happens, and, you know, we're not complaining that things could be far worse.
Oh, exactly, exactly. But
it has...
By way of explanation, this is why you're getting a shorter episode, so there you go.
This is why you're getting probably a shorter episode, more of an easy subject for Cindy and I to discuss Star Trek, classic Star Trek, which we can discuss without ever even watching the episode again. The house has been a wreck. You know, where we record normally is the dining room table. That's been piled up with stuff from the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't even, you know, we haven't been able to prep this episode in advance like we normally would. So we decided to take it a bit easy. I know we did a TV episode last time, but that was with Michael Bailey, and we had a lot of fun with it. And normally we won't do two TV episodes in a row, but you know what, this time we are. So there you go. Plus, I'm in a Star Trek kind of mood anyway, because I got Mark Cushman's third volume of These Are the Voyages.
Mm-hmm.
That is a awesome, exhaustive book that takes you through every season of Trek. You know, there's a book for season one, season two, and then season three. And it takes you like a day-by-day journal through production, pre-production, production of each episode. And those books were actually recommended to me by our buddy Andy Leyland of Hey Kids Comics.
Mm-hmm.
And Listen to the Prophets, which is a Deep Space Nine podcast, and many other fine podcasts on the Two True Freaks Network. And I think the thing that to take away from season three, which we have done an episode of season three already, which we'll get to in a minute. Season three gets a bad rap. It's the worst season. You know, the quality slipped. The Roddenberry stepped away. Gene Kuhn was gone. They hired Fred Freeberger, who has this reputation of not being the best of TV producers. And in fact, there's something called a Freeberger season, you know. But if you read Cushman's book and you look at the actual ratings of Star Trek throughout his books, he dispels the theory that Star Trek had bad ratings, that Star Trek wasn't popular in its initial run. It was. It had good ratings. It won in ratings for NBC. It was often number one. It was almost, if not number one, it was always number two. Very few times was it number three. So it had good ratings. But if you read that book, the thing that jumps out at you is NBC and Gene Roddenberry hated each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had a mad on for Roddenberry before Star Trek was ever picked up. He had done a series for him before, and they had locked horns over that show, The Lieutenant, which actually starred Gary Lockwood, who played Gary Mitchell in Where No Man Has Gone Before. And they didn't want to work with Roddenberry again, but they wanted to work with Lucille Ball's Desilu, and that's why they picked up Star Trek.
Mm.
Because he went to Desilu, and then the people at Desilu, they liked the people that worked at Desilu, and they come over and said, hey, we got this show, Star Trek, and they're like, oh, sounds good. Yeah, Gene Roddenberry's doing it, and you could, yeah, you know. So
yeah.
I mean, there was just this, and Roddenberry did not like playing in the network system, and you can see how Star Trek The Next Generation came from his experiences here, because Star Trek The Next Generation was syndicated, no network to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
As time wore on, Gene Roddenberry disliked the funny and chummy nature of the relationship between Kirk, Spock, and Bones. So when Gene Kuhn had pushed when he was the main producer and Roddenberry was executive producer, so he, when Kuhn left and he hired first John Meredith Lucas and then Freeburger in this season, he, you know, said, tone that down. Well, Next Generation, what do you get? They're all very proper, mm-hmm. much more dry. They're boring. They're much more boring than Kirk and company, in my opinion. So that, I mean, you can just see it. So I'm having a heck of a time reading this book, and it's a lot of fun. I highly recommend it. And you know, since we're part of the Fire and Water Network, I don't know if In Stock Trades has that book, but go see if they do. You know, if not, get it from Amazon, because it's a great book.
I know I had initially bought that for you for your Christmas this year, and your dad came and he's like, okay, so what are some ideas about what to get Chris for Christmas? And I'm like, well, there's this, you know, I was giving him a list. I'm like, he's like, what about this? What about this Star Trek book? I'm like, oh, I already bought it. I've got it here. You know, I was going to give it to him. He said, well, can I give it to him? I got him into Star Trek. I want to give it to him. I'm like, damn it. So I had to go buy something else.
Well,
I handed it over.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's something, I mean, me and Dad can talk about for sure. And Dad still, we were talking about it last night. I was naming off episodes. He still remembers them. Mm-hmm. And even though he hasn't watched them, you know, like we have, you know, over and over again, he still remembers. He remembered this one. I mentioned this one. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm, you know. You know, he got me into Star Trek. He did. So after years of trying to get me to watch it, when I was about 6 or something, I finally started watching it. And actually, the episode we're going to talk about tonight is The Paradise Syndrome. Okay, this one is similar to the last classic Trek we covered, All Our Yesterdays, which is also from Season 3. Because you got one of the command crew gets stranded on an endangered planet, and he's not acting like himself. He finds love with a woman from a primitive culture, and then he's forced to leave her behind. So, kind of similar. It's like, I don't know, it's like, once we got to think about it, when we picked this one, I'm like, you know, this is kind of, you know, got some similar things mm-hmm. going on. And I don't know, we've started a doomed love story of Star Trek. I don't have to take to it, you know.
So, I guess we've got to do, you know, I know what we're doing in January next year.
Yeah. Oh, okay. The Paradise Syndrome originally aired October 4th, 1968. It was written by Margaret Armin, directed by Judd Taylor. It had the usual cast of Shatner, Nimoy, Kelly, Doohan,
yada,
Nichols,
yada,
Takai, Koenig, Barrett, you know. So we had Sabrina Scharf as Miramani, Rudy Solari as Salish, and Richard Hale as Goro.
Kirk, Spock, and McCoy beam down to a lush planet in the path of an oncoming asteroid due to arrive and destroy it in 2 months. They discover a strange obelisk made of an alien material that blocks their tricorders and covered with mysterious markings. They also observe a village of humanoids very similar to primitive Native Americans. As they prepare to leave to intercept the asteroid in an attempt to deflect it, Kirk, lost in thoughts of his peaceful surroundings and what Bones calls Tahiti Syndrome, revisits the obelisk.
What's the matter, Jim?
What? Oh, nothing. Just so peaceful. Uncomplicated, no problems, no command decisions. Just living.
Typical human reaction to an idyllic natural setting. Back in the 20th century, we referred to it as the Tahiti Syndrome. It's particularly common to overpressured leader types like starship captains.
Ah, Tahiti Syndrome. Let's go take care of that asteroid. But first, I want another look at that obelisk.
When he activates his communicator and hails the Enterprise, the floor of the obelisk slides underneath him and he falls into a chamber inside. As he grasps about to pull himself up, he accidentally activates the advanced mechanisms inside. A beam of electricity zaps him and he collapses.
Unable to find their captain, Spock and an angry McCoy are forced to return to the Enterprise as their window to deflect the asteroid is fading. While they travel at maximum warp speed to meet their deflection point, Kirk awakens in the hidden chamber, but his memory is gone. He stumbles up the stairs, and the doors open once more. His exit is observed by 2 native women, who take him for a god. The High Priestess Miramani takes him to the Elder Goro and Medicine Chief Salish. Goro believes Kirk is the god of their legends, sent to save them from the darkening skies they have recently witnessed. Kirk remembers coming from the sky and emerging from the temple, but little else. Salish doubts Kirk's godhood, but his protests are soon forgotten when the captain uses CPR to save a young boy who nearly drowned. Goro orders Salish to give up his sacred medicine badge, and Miramani places it on Kirk.
Arriving at the rendezvous with the asteroid, the Enterprise's deflectors prove to be useless against the large mass of rock. Spock takes another calculated risk, heading the ship directly toward the asteroid, in the hopes the ship's phasers will be able to split the giant rock. Meanwhile, Salish learns that Miramani is now betrothed to the new medicine man, per the customs of their people. Worse yet for Salish, she prefers her new god over her old husband-to-be. Miramani tells Kirk of the Wise Ones and how they deposited her people on the planet and chose a medicine chief to use the temple's secrets to defend the planet when the skies darken. Those secrets were passed down from father to son, but Salish's father died before sharing his knowledge. Goro asks what he should call their new god, and from Kirk's garbled memories, he chooses the name Kirok. Kirok remembers very little, but he feels he is happier and more peaceful than he has ever been.
The Enterprise takes its shot at the asteroid, but the phasers fail to split the rock, and the ship's warp capabilities are drained. Miramani informs Kirok that they are to be joined in marriage, and he couldn't be more pleased. Back on the Enterprise, the ship heads back to the planet, 4 hours in front of the asteroid at impulse power. As usual, McCoy questions Spock's every move, especially as he studies video of the obelisk's interior.
Well, Spock, you took your calculated risk in your calculated Vulcan way, and you lost. You lost for us, you lost for that planet, and you lost for Jim.
I accept the responsibility, Doctor.
And my responsibility is the health of this crew. You've been driving yourself too hard, and I want you to get some rest.
Mr. Chekhov, resume heading 883, Mark 4-1.
Back to that planet without warp speed? It'll take months, Spock.
Exactly 59.223 days, Doctor. And that asteroid will be 4 hours behind us all the way.
Well, then what's the use? We might not be able to save the captain even if he still is alive. We might not be able to save anything, including the ship. You haven't heard a word I've said. All you've been doing is staring at that blasted obelisk.
Another calculated Vulcan risk, Doctor.
On his way to his joining with Miramani, a blissful Kirok is assaulted by a jealous Salish, who manages to cut him with his dagger.
Bleed! Bleed, Kirok! Behold a god who bleeds!
Kirok makes quick work of his foe, but refuses to kill him. Kirok and Miramani are joined in her native marriage ritual.
Weeks pass, and while Spock and McCoy continue to bicker aboard the Enterprise, Kirok frolics in the woods with his bride. Despite his happiness, Kirok still dreams of the strange lodge which moves through the sky. His inner turmoil is quickly forgotten when Miramani tells him she is pregnant with his child. Kirok's returning memories allow him to develop lamps and plan irrigation canals to increase food supply, but their plans are dashed when the skies darken and the storms return. Goro begs Kirok to go to the temple and use its powers to save them. Although he is unsure what to do, Kirok arrives at the obelisk and cries at the sky for guidance. As Salish watches his ineffectiveness, he smiles.
On the Enterprise, Spock reveals to McCoy that he has deciphered that the symbols on the obelisk are musical notes. Furthermore, the object is a marker left by an ancient race called the Preservers, who seeded the galaxy with endangered races. They deduced that the obelisk is also a defective asteroid deflector. They must hurry to get it back in operation before it's too late.
On the planet's surface, Salish leads the people against Kirok. They hurl stones at him and the arriving Miramani, knocking both unconscious. The assailants flee when Spock and McCoy transport down. They call for Nurse Chapel, who administers pain reliever to the injured Miramani, while Spock attempts to use the Vulcan mind meld on Kirk to jumpstart his memory. The captain appears to resist, letting his Kirok identity go, but soon snaps back to his old self. While McCoy and Chapel attend to his wife, Kirk is filled in on the situation. He realizes he activated the door by using his communicator and repeating what he said 2 months ago. This allows him to open the obelisk. Inside, Spock goes through his usual long-winded explanation until his captain orders him to press the right button. He does, and the obelisk deflector beam repels the asteroid away.
Back at the lodge, McCoy informs Kirk that Miramani will soon die from her injuries.
Kirk, it is true you are safe.
And so are your people, Miramani.
I knew you would save them, my chief. When I am better, it will be as it was. Will it not?
If that's what you want.
We will live long and happy lives. I will bear you many strong sons. I love you all.
And I love you, Miramani.
They both reaffirm their love for one another, with Kirk comforting his wife as she passes on. A little behind the scenes before we get into the blow-by-blow of what we thought of it. Margaret Armin had written The Gamesters of Triskelion for Season 2, so Roddenberry put her on assignment before he basically vacated the series production and handed the reins over to the much maligned Fred Freeberger, as we discussed. According to Mark Cushman's book, Armin's outline for the Pale Face, thank God they changed that name, differed from the final version in several ways. First off, the obelisk was a totem pole located in a previous asteroid crater. Kirk falls into it, he bumps his head, and that's how he gets amnesia, you know, typical sitcom stuff. Salish is in line to be chief and fights Kirk. But when he loses, Salish takes it well and he doesn't oppose him and he kind of just fades into the background, which is quite different than this. The biggest change, and it's quite a whopper, is that the story takes place over a much longer period of time and Miramani actually gives birth to Kirk's child. And when Spock returns, Kirk leads his people against him. They beam all aboard to the Enterprise, and Kirk doesn't recover his memory until he almost stabs Spock with his dagger. They activate the deflector, and a saddened Kirk leaves the tribe and Miramani and his child behind in Salish's hands. So Kirk would have been a deadbeat dad before Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. I did what you said. I stayed away. You know. anyway. A later rewrite had Miramani frightened of the Enterprise in Kirk's world, so he let her stay behind on the planet with their unborn child. Again, he would have been a deadbeat dad. The third season's budget was severely cut, despite the fact that very few Trek episodes of the previous seasons ever came in under budget anyway, proving that the show couldn't be shot for such a low cost. So it's like the first season had a bigger budget, had a big budget, but they didn't. They always were going over it, no matter what they did. Even after they got kind of down to a science, they cut the budget for season two, some, not a whole lot, but some. They still were going over. So for season three, they cut it even more.
And so of course they went over.
So of course, well, actually, when they actually, if as I'm reading this book, they're getting to where they're not going over. But that's when it's really starting to look cheap.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're not filming any extra coverage for scenes and cuts and things. And there's a lot of mistakes slipping through the cracks. But they didn't have a budget for location shooting at all. This is the only one that was shot on location. Whereas, you know, the other seasons had a handful of episodes that were shot.
Right.
On location. This one was actually shot at Upper Franklin Canyon in the Hollywood Hills.
Woohoo! Franklin. Yeah. Go Franklins!
Yeah. You can actually tell that much of the dialogue outside had to be re-recorded and looped. Apparently there was a noisy freeway just on the other side of the trees.
Oh.
So, you know, they could have just went for help, you know. at the freeway. One thing that jumped out at me, and I've read this in several books, but it jumped out at me too. Our heroes seem kind of surprised to find an Earth-like planet, but isn't that the whole point of a Class M planet?
That it's supposed to be able to sustain human life.
Well, and they've also, how many planets have they been to that have been like Earth, you know? I mean, Miri's planet for one, you know, it's like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Do we blame this on the new producer, Freight Freeberger, and the new story editor, Arthur Singer, because DC Fontana is no longer around? Probably so. Bone says a few lines about no meteor craters. In the earlier drafts, the fact that the planet is in the midst of an asteroid belt is better explained than in the filmed episode. Did you get that? That the planet was, like, in a heavy asteroid area?
Oh, I mean, it was one of those, I was just like...
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, there's a couple little lines that Bone says, but the fact, I think they, if they, you know, made that more obvious in the aired episode, it would have, you know, given the obelisk and, well, how do they, you know, stop these things from, you know, there's no big craters and it's not destroyed. And I mean, they make a couple of things like that, but it, you know, it's another one of those cases where from the writer's pen to the screen, it didn't, just didn't quite translate. Apparently, according to IMDb, apparently the traits of Miramani's people don't match the Navajo, Mohegan, and Delaware Indians' way of living that Spock describes.
I'm sorry, but I call bullshit on that. Because the whole point is if you've had, if the preservers had taken three tribes thousands of years ago, they would have melded together to where their individual characteristics wouldn't have been visible.
Right.
They would have intermarried, intermingled. You know, it would not have been possible. Also, how the flipping crap is Spock supposed to tell that way over from the lake? And they're like, you know, oh, let's see. These people have a high bridge line. And then, you know, no. What? No. No. Just no. I call BS.
Well, and I mean, let's face it. You know, Hollywood wasn't known for depicting
Native Americans.
They had a very generic, you know, they didn't worry about what tribes, you know, certain divisions of Native Americans did versus, you know, on one side of the country to another or one state to another, whatever. So, I mean, you know, you're not going to get, in 1968, you're not going to get authenticity in that department. None of your... The TV landscape was full of Westerns. And this is just, you know, even though it's on a different planet, this is just as authentic looking as any of those, and more so than a lot of them. So, McCoy asks if they should tell the people about the asteroid.
Was that the prom director?
Yeah, isn't there something?
I know, I thought the same thing. I'm like, what?
Yeah, it's like, and nobody ever even, I mean, that just goes to show you how, you know, Star Trek is under new management, because nobody, you know, that if DC Fontana had been there, she'd wrote in a line, prime directive. I don't know why Robert Justman didn't, because he was still there.
Right.
But it's like, you know, prime directive, you know, I mean, you know, somebody would have caught it, you know.
What kills me is they go down to explore this planet. Number one, why on earth, you know, if they've got so long to get there, you know, to get to this deflection point, why did they cut it so close?
Yeah.
Then they go down to explore the planet initially, and they've got 30 minutes to explore it?
Yeah.
What?
And I mean, we've seen the Enterprise sensors be able to pinpoint how many life forms are on a planet and where they're at.
Uh-huh.
So why did they have to beam down and, you know, couldn't they have, like, you know, looked at them from the, you know, some kind of, you know, probe
and
or something?
And time is so short, but, you know, Kirk and Bones are like, oh, let's go have another look. We've got 30, you know. Well, let's just go ahead and look again.
Yeah, there's some interesting, yeah, there's some interesting things there where it's like, you know, Kirk's like, you guys stand around here while I go look over at the obelisk by myself. And McCoy's like taking readings, and Spock's like, I would wait and take those readings after we have deflected the asteroid, Doctor, blah, blah,
but
blah.
But at the same time, he's like, we have to do numerous probes while we're here in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
They must have... I'm not going to make that joke. That's me.
based on what we see of Kirk's paradise in Star Trek Generations, which we'll get back to later, we can understand why Kirk has Tahiti syndrome here. Mm-hmm. I mean, because this is kind of place setting is revisited later, yeah, that this is something Kirk likes, you know. I will say, you know, despite the truncated budget and everything, the obelisk is damn impressive.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's a full-size, full-scale prop.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's made of, like, marble. Yeah. I mean, it's really impressive looking. Or some kind of strange metal, you know. Mm-hmm. That's Matt Jeffries again. I mean, to design the Enterprise and just about everything that any importance on Star Trek. So he was just a genius. So
yeah,
I love Shatner. I mean, I love the guy. You know, just the, you know, if Shatner's in something, he gets a smile out of me just because he's in it. But I will say, you know, people pick on him and stuff. He gets pretty hammy in parts of this one.
Oh, honey, he needed scalloped potatoes on the side and he'd been a meal.
But when the, like, starting off when he gets zapped by the beam, the look on his face is just really, like, you know, over. Which, I mean, I know they had no idea how they were going to animate, what they were going to do with it. You know, I mean, they're working with nothing, you know. So, I mean, I understand that. And they're trying to get this done quick. And
oh, I'm still going to make fun of
it. But yeah. But, I mean, it's, you know, it is definitely one of those moments where every comedian, whoever lampooned Shatner, they just got proven right, you know.
Yeah.
Basically. And there's more of that to come in this one. And there's also some really good, you know, sensitive acting by him, too. Some subtle acting by him. But there's some ham there, too. You know, so Kirk gets zapped. He's in the obelisk, and you know they got to take off to meet the asteroid, the deflection point.
Why?
Couldn't? Why? Why? What do you mean?
Here's my point about the whole thing. Why couldn't they have left bones there to search?
Well,
why couldn't they have sent a shuttle down with somebody and said, "Bones, we're going to leave you here to search. We're going to send a shuttle out, but we got to go."
Hmm.
You know.
Well, why couldn't they just send a security detail to search? I mean, Bones wouldn't have had to have gone. I can understand them not wanting to leave, you know, Bones there, but they could have left, like...
They have Nurse Chapel on board, and she has all of her medical training.
Well, I know.
So they didn't
need... And they have Dr. Mabinga on there sometimes, too, or whatever his name is.
Yeah, but, you know, why didn't they leave Bones down there to search?
Yeah.
And then put a shuttle there and said, you know, as soon as I get to the ship, I'm going to send a shuttle out, but I've got to go to this deflection point.
Well, I mean, even if they left a group of red shirts down there to search for him and gave him, you know, they have shown up in the appropriate clothing before, so they'll blend in. They could have, you know,
right,
made them up to look like the natives. And
but then you're talking about having time, you know, they're already,
yeah,
on a tight schedule. If they had just said, Bones, we're going to leave you down here. I got to get back. I'm going to send a shuttle. Done.
Well, you know, but just imagine if a search party had encountered Salish or something, that would have been another wrinkle, you know, mm-hmm, if they'd been there, you know. But one thing Gene Roddenberry complained about so far as I'm reading this book, and like every episode, the Enterprise seems kind of vacant. We need more crew members and this and that. Well, the budget was cut. They couldn't pay a lot of extras.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that's, if you notice, the third season especially is where, I know Kirk always brings Spock and McCoy, which I know doesn't make any sense, that he brings, you know,
yeah,
his second...
Yeah, but it's a guy and his best friends. Come on, let's go do something.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, I like that part. That's the adventure part of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And that's the part I like the best. But, you know, they used to bring a security detail down with them every time, and mm-hmm, a red shirt would get killed, right?
Oh,
but
yeah.
Season three...
That's what they're for.
Yeah, exactly. Season three, it was almost always just those three. And that's mm-hmm, it. No security guards, because they couldn't afford to pay them, I guess. You can understand, though, why Miramani and her handmaiden mistook Kirk for a god, because with his clothes and his shat swagger as he comes up out of the temple, he's all, you know, I mean, it's pretty impressive looking, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, to them, it's like, you know, if I was them, I'd probably think the same thing. Mm-hmm. So, it's not said in the episode, but the medicine badge that Salish and Kirk wear looks like it may have come from the Wise Ones, because it's metal and the way it's formed, it looks kind of futuristic and, you know.
I couldn't help it looking at the badge. I mean, especially the different ways you're looking at it. If you look later on, you can tell it's supposed to be the obelisk on the Medicine Chief.
Yeah.
But when you first see it, it looks like an L. So it looks like they've got a big L loser on their forehead. I kept thinking that the whole time. I'm like, oh my gosh.
That meant something. If here, Salish, we want you to wear this. And they're like, snickering and starting to say, I will wear it with honor. Yeah, loser.
I mean, I kept thinking, it's got a big L on his forehead.
What I like is the very elastic headband.
I know. It's elastic. I'm like.
She like pulls it off. Miramani pulls it off him. You could like, she could like snap it back. It's like, pull it back and like smack him right in the forehead.
I'm like, kind of advanced for a primitive society.
Yeah,
they got elastic.
We've got elastic. This episode.
And she was quick to take the badge from old Shayla's. Poor thing. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Not you. Come here. Give me here. Okay, Kurt.
Yep. Hey, it's the chat, you know. This episode, of course, explains how humanoids are spread throughout the galaxy, which, you know, we get into that more later. But in reverse, it also works that ancient alien bit for Earth in, too, because, you know, it's like, well, that could have been what happened here, you know.
With pyramids, yada,
yeah,
yada.
Yeah, exactly.
But the whole thing is, do they ever revisit this in the Star Trek universe, the preservers, the idea of the preservers?
Oh, I'm sure they do in a novel or something, but...
Well, but I'm talking about on the series, like even on Next Generation or something like that.
You know, Next Generation tended to not really revisit a lot of the classic Trek stuff.
Yes, they did. Their whole first season was Star Trek, the First Generation, redone in that way.
I know, but I mean, they redid the plots, but actually the characters, and other than the Klingons and the Romulans, and they tended to not, the individual episodes, they didn't, you know, they never went to the Guardian of Forever and things like that, you know, which was So, I mean, yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. You can kind of understand why Salish has a mat on for Kirk. Like we said, his woman takes off his elastic headband and puts it on Kirk right in front of everybody. And then Miramani, she won't even lie to him about who she would choose. She could have said, you know, I'm really sorry, but I know we had plans, but, you know, our culture just says I got to marry him, so sorry, you know. But no.
I mean, super quick. I mean, you know. I'm sorry, but it is, I'm trying to figure out of a nice for airtime word for this.
Right, go ahead.
It's a douche move that she uses the whole cloak that she's been working on for her and Shailish to share for their mating ritual. She's like, you know what? I'm going to use it for Kirk, you know? It's just like buying a wedding dress. You're going to marry this person, but, you know, it doesn't work out. But I'm going to marry this guy, but I'm going to use my way, you know, waste not, want not, I guess.
Like a guy giving an engagement ring to two different
women. Yes. Oh, same thing. I'm just like, oh my, no.
I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. And what about Shailish's dad? I mean, you think about that.
You mean the one that died?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
You think about this. Shailish's dad knew... Either Shailish's dad was a butthead who did not share the secrets because he wanted to keep the power for himself.
Yeah.
Or he knew that Shailish was a butthead and didn't want him to have the power and was hoping something would happen so that he wouldn't be the medicine man.
Good point.
So it's one of the two things.
Well,
you
can kind of understand either runs in the family or he could see that in his son. That's a good point, yeah. I thought the asteroid looked pretty good,
yeah.
You know, especially with the truncated budget. I actually watched we watched this on from the Star Trek DVDs, the season sets, but Netflix has the enhanced version,
yeah.
You know, with the newer effects and the CGI Enterprise and everything. So I actually went, after we watched it the old way, I just, you know, flipped through it and watched the effect shots in it. And, I mean, they try not to make it too obvious that they change it. They try to keep within the spirit of it. And, you know, the asteroid looked a little more maybe realistic and stuff, but I didn't see where they improved it all that much myself.
Nah.
But, you know. This is one of the few times I recall the deflector on the front of the ship actually being used. It's used in every other episode of TNG as the Deus Ex Machina, but here it's the only time I can recall them, like, shooting a beam out of the deflector.
Right.
Which was cool. Of course, it didn't do anything. What happened to the photon torpedoes? I mean, they fired the phasers and drained the engines, but the photon torpedoes, as far as I know, don't take any power from the ship.
They're already there.
Because, I mean, in Star Trek 2, we see them, and 6, we see them, I know that's later, but we see them load them. Yeah. And obviously they take one and put Spock's body in it. So, you know, it's just like a regular torpedo nowadays. It's just, it explodes because it's got like, you know, I don't know, photon explosive in it or something, you know. Why didn't they try that?
Because it's in the script.
Yeah. We don't have photon torpedoes this week.
Not this one.
Yep. Kirok doesn't protest getting married at all, which I think is interesting, you know.
Well, he wants to nail her, you know, that short little buckskin dress,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, she's pretty hot, you know. Yeah. Chesty, too.
But what about Kirk? This whole episode, if you notice, everybody else, whoever his makeup person was for this episode,
yeah,
he's sweaty the whole episode. I'm like, honey, use a little dab on your forehead. You know, a little sweaty there.
Well, I think they were trying to show, I mean, he kept rubbing his forehead. I think they were trying to show that he was really, like, concentrating, trying to remember or something. It was.
Yeah, but all it did was, I just kept thinking, oh, honey, no, no.
I noticed at one point him and Miramani are having this wonderful moment. I think when she's telling him, we'll get into that later, but that she's pregnant, and a fly lands on Shatner's forehead, and he just keeps going. But, you know, they probably he probably figured the way the show was running nowadays, they wouldn't reshoot it if he didn't go ahead and do it. Man, every time Spock takes command, both Scotty and McCoy give him a whole lot of shit every single time.
Uh-huh.
I would have demoted both of them.
Yeah.
I've just been like, you know what? Shut the hell up. And, you know, go grab a broom and sweep up because your ass is done here. All right? when Bones, like, turned around and left the room, I think I would have Vulcan nerve pinched him and, like, shoved him in a closet somewhere. It's like, just shut the hell up. Just quit grousing at my ass all the time. You know, I mean, I love Bones, but damn.
Yeah.
Come on. Salish is a creeper, okay? He's standing outside of Miramani's tent while her maidens dress her. Perv? Come on.
Yeah.
They're all like, you know, they're putting on her nice pretty dress and they're all getting her ready. And the camera pans over. He's standing there, got his, you know, he's lifting up the TP flap just looking in at him. It's like, God dang, man. What the hell? When, you know, Goro, like, puts the paint on Kirok's face, and, you know, they're getting ready for the ceremony, and he's standing up on the obelisk, the temple, and, you know, there's this monologue that, you know, you hear Kirok's thoughts.
I have found paradise. Surely no man has ever attained such happiness.
I'm so happy. And and he gives himself this really super cheesy, like, puts his arms out and gives himself this self-hug that's just...
Yeah.
Just like, oh, I love you so much. You know, it's just, I mean, it's just... I mean, it's a little... I know they were trying to tell us that Kirk has never been this at peace. He's never been this happy. But I think... they could have done it in a slightly more subtle fashion. That's one thing that season 3 is not as subtle at all.
No, 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 no.
It's not subtle at all. I mean, it's just not. Any subtleties that were in the previous seasons are out the door as they try to hammer things out as they go along. Shat does get some good moves in on Salish when they fight because he...
But it's actually a pretty good fight.
It is a good fight. And I went and looked at it again when I was... A lot of it's Shatner himself.
Yeah.
Because he swings around that tree and kicks him. And, mm-hmm. and then he does the flying drop kick on him. So he gets two drop kicks on him.
Yeah.
A tree swinging one and a flying one. Mm. So it's like a bonus. Like, so there you go, Salish. You just got a bonus ass whooping. So how's that? So did the Enterprise fly backwards in front of the asteroid for 2 months? I mean, I know the whole thing in space, there's no up and down, there's no, you know.
Right,
I know
still.
All that, but, you know, can you imagine the beeping sound driving everybody nuts?
What I want to know is, you know, this takes them 2 months.
Yeah.
But why didn't Kirk banish Salish for trying to kill him?
Hmm.
I mean, that would have been totally within his power, but, I mean, apparently... Yeah, you tried to kill me, but I'm just going to let it go.
Or tell Goro about it.
Yeah.
Well, I guess Kirk kind of, he probably, figured, well, you know, the guy has a right to hate me. You know, I just swooped in and took his woman and his job. So, I mean, he probably thought, you know, maybe that's what he was thinking. I don't know. He probably didn't think, well, he's going to stone me later, you know, which he does. But the jump to 58 days later could have been handled a bit better.
Definitely. Instead of showing them frolicking through the woods in one continuous scene for, what was it, 2.5 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
They could have shown, you know, them sharing a meal, them doing, the, you know, there's a, they could have done a little montage there.
Yeah.
That, you know, that would have been a lot better.
Yeah. I mean, a montage, you know, is the, even back then, was the tried and true way to show the passage of time.
Yeah.
And then you could have got to the Enterprise and everybody's got a beard.
No.
I'm punchy tonight.
No kidding.
I'm just having fun with this. But, yeah, that's true. I mean, I thought the scenes of them frolicking in the woods did go a long way to showing the relationship, and it was very sweet. And,
but it was too long.
I don't know.
No, but it was, I'm going to get you. I'm going to get you. Yeah, I'm going to get you. I'm going to get you down, and I'm going to tickle you. Yeah, here it comes.
Mary Money. I've got my shirt off. It's shirtless Kirk time.
Yes. I'm halfway there. Let's make a baby.
Yeah, he done made it. Because she tells him she's pregnant. After he says, you know, the dreams of the strange lodge that flies through the sky. Back on the Enterprise, you know, Bones sure has calmed down a lot. He basically apologizes to Spock.
Mm-hmm.
So quit beating himself up and get some rest, which is, you know, probably a first. You know, we were wrong to blame you. It's like, well, you know.
But he's an idiot because he's like, okay, if you don't get some rest, even though you've told me repeatedly that you need to work on this, I'm going to have the security officers in here. Oh, yes, I'm going to take some rest. Okay, I believe you, even though you're a stubborn Vulcan. And just walks out. Of course Spock was going to get up.
Yeah.
Duh.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. Talking about her telling him she's pregnant, it still surprises me that they went that far to have her be pregnant. That they, especially the, given the fate of her and the baby.
But that makes it even more tragic.
Well, it does make it more tragic, but I mean, it's just, it's kind of surprising that they would go there, you know, with the killing of the child as well as, you know, as well as her. You know, of course, everyone remembers, I am Kirok! I'm Kirok! You know, everybody remembers that, but, you know, I you can't blame the guy for trying. They're like, you've got to stop this. And he's like, well, I don't know what the hell to do.
I can't help it. Whenever I see him do that, I flashed back to Steve Carroll in 40-Year-Old Virgin, where he's going, Age of Aquarius. That's what went through my head.
Harmony and understanding. Yeah, it's, you could. Now that you said, I could just see all the Native Americans coming out. You know, this is the dawning of the age. With him standing on the obelisk.
Telling you.
Well, that's from Hair, and he is sporting some awesomely massive sideburns.
Well,
his
yeah.
little pointy sideburns. He didn't grow a beard now because Shatner has no body hair. And can't grow a beard, but he did grow out his sideburns. He, you know, they're not just the points anymore. They filled out backwards toward his ears. You know,
yeah, they're all fuzzy.
They're fuzzy. He's almost getting the like Hugh Jackman mutton chops going on. So we do get to see, you know, back on the ship, we get to see Spock jam out on his Vulcan lyre thing, mm-hmm. you know, a bit, which is always cool. Good to see. And that's how he figures out, you know, that they're musical notes.
What I thought was funny, and I pointed this out when we were watching the episode, he's got the bell things, like when he went back to Vulcan, you know, the things
yeah.
that they shake. I thought those were just ceremonial for the Vulcan wedding ceremony. I thought that was the only time you saw those.
Maybe when he was walking out, he was like, all right, T'Pring, you bitch, she ain't going to marry me, but I'm taking them damn bells.
You are punchy. Gosh.
Sorry. The kids aren't here either, which is, they're spending the night at a friend's house, and we're being a little more, you know, raunchier than usual, too. I'm saying cursing a lot more than usual. So I apologize if I'm offending you, but, you know, Didn't mean to.
I don't apologize. It's my personality. Deal with it.
It's just coming out more. I'm just having fun. But, you know, that's, I think, but I will give them credit for, they still, you know, they make Spock's quarters look like his quarters.
Yeah.
That, I mean, you know, the, it looks like the chair he's even sitting in looks like it's like carved wood and,
yeah.
You know, it's neat, you know, because, you know, everything else, you know, looks like the rest of the Enterprise, but that doesn't. His quarters do not. And they continue that through the movies, too. You see different things, like even in Star Trek VI, which is cool. So, Spock and McCoy just discovered why human life is so prevalent in the galaxy, but they blow by that pretty quick.
See, again, you would think that they would revisit that later. Even if they didn't revisit that in the series, because, you know, this is the third season, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But they should have, and maybe they do, maybe there's something that I'm not aware of, but it seems like you would have that come up again, whether it be in the movies or Next Generation, right, or, you know, somewhere.
That'd been a good thing for Q to bring up. Well, the only reason your people are out here, Jean-Luc, is because the Preservers dropped you everywhere or something.
And have
Picard give him a kind of startled look, and then they go back and look at the databanks and said, oh,
but
yes.
But to me, you know, that, to me, by Picard's time, something that,
they would have been known everywhere. Spock would have published a paper.
Exactly. It would have been required reading at the Academy.
Right, right.
I think it would be.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Kirk really must have been at peace, or he'd started cracking some heads for having rocks thrown at him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like he just stood there and took it. I mean, which is, and what, you know, and then Miramati comes up there. Once they start throwing rocks at her, I would have stage dived into that crowd and started beating the hell out of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I would have done.
Or at least went around to the other side.
Yeah, they could have went around the other side and run off. But
I mean, it's an obelisk. It has multiple sides. Move.
Yeah, you know, you could have recreated the scene from Young Frankenstein when he jumps out of the crowd. Don't anger him. Stop it. So why didn't they beam Kirk and Miramati back to the Enterprise at some point? Especially her. I mean, why didn't McCoy just beam back up with her? I think they wanted her to die in her camp and
her planet
and her lodge and everything. But at the same time, it's like it makes it look like they really, I mean,
they didn't try
to save her very hard.
No.
It's like, who's this woman laying here? And even after he says, my wife, Spock's like,
your wife?
His wife.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like they didn't, I don't know if it's the way the episode's cut together. I mean, Shatner keeps coming back over to her in between times talking to Spock, to the point where Spock's like, Captain, you know, we're running out of time here. Which I thought, something I thought was really kind of interesting, I didn't write this down, but I mentioned it earlier, when they first find, they beam down and the natives, of course, run off, and they come up to Kirk and Miramati's bodies, and, you know, of course, they're looking at Kirk, they're more worried about him, which is understandable, and they don't know that she's his wife, obviously, yet. But Sulu, you know, calls him on a communicator, and he's like, 65 minutes to impact, Mr. Spock. And there's that, Nimoy actually goes like, you can just see him like, thank you, Mr. Sulu. It's just like, damn it. he's that guy that's, you know, usually Spock does that to other people.
Yeah.
And Sulu, of course, he's warp what? Warp two. You know, he's that guy too.
Yeah.
And so now Spock's getting annoyed by somebody doing it to him, which I liked. And which, you know, it's very subtle, but that just shows, you know, that it, you know, they're in the middle of a crisis. Spock just found his buddy, don't know what he's been missing for 2 months. And, you know, he doesn't know if he's dead, what the hell's going on, why he's dressed the way he is, you know. And, you know, here's Sulu calling and give him a, you know,
a time.
Which, what episode? Oh, it's the Corbomite maneuver where Sulu's like counting off the time they have left, you know, with Baylock and whatever the other guy's name, Bailey, that was there beside him that stays with Baylock. He's like, oh, now this guy's counting down. You know, it's like he's doing a countdown, which is, so now Spock's taking the place of that guy going, oh, God, Sulu. But anyway, so Spock mind melds with Kirk a bit in Spectre of the Gun, but apparently he never dug so deep, you know. I like his line about Kirk being an extremely dynamic individual. That's saying, you know, that goes without saying, but mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's somewhat symbolic that they, you know, Kirk says, you know, opens his communicator, the beep beeps, and says Kirk to Enterprise, the door to the obelisk opens. Well, Miramati's body is on top of it, mm-hmm. and it slides over. It's almost like his life with her is being pushed away because he has to be Kirk again to stop it. You know, it's kind of, it's probably, they didn't mean that, but it's because you feel bad. It's like, oh man, she's sitting there dying and her body's like getting slid over while, you know, McCoy and Chapel are really good. You know, they're just standing there watching her. It's,
I know he couldn't, there had to been some way that, you know, if it had been 15 minutes longer and she had survived and said, you know, if she had said, you know, she had lost the baby, but she survived.
Right.
You know.
Right.
I can't live with you and your, you know, I can't deal with your world.
But then Kirk would have been married and out running around on her when he ran into, even though they weren't, maybe they were married in her culture or whatever.
Married. He was married.
I know, but that's what I'm saying. They would have been married, and he would have been running around meeting other women every week, you know, which is one reason why the official reason why they got rid of Yeoman Rand. So, yeah, I just think they could have illustrated. I know they couldn't get gory back then, and in fact, there's even, I'm reading about the episode Day of the Dove now, and it, for whatever reason, even though it was on later at night, Season 3, NBC wouldn't basically let them have show any kind of blood or anything. I mean, even when they're fighting with swords and this and that. So they weren't going to let them show her bloodied up or anything. Which, I mean, they weren't going to get overly gory then anyway. But, I mean, it doesn't look like she's hit hard enough to really...
Her hair ain't even mussed up. There's no scratches. There's no dirt. You know, her hair's not even messed up. She's like...
laying there with her legs crossed as...
Yeah, well, one leg is up provocatively, like, I'm laying on this bearskin rug. Oh.
Yeah, I just think they kind of, I think they could have done more with, one, her injuries. If she's really going to die, which we know she does, then they should have had her, the injuries should have been more convincing, and two, Bones and Chapel should have seemed more competent in trying to save her.
Right. I mean, they're like, she's going to die.
Yeah. It's like Nurse Chapel does the, you know, cigarette lighter thingy on her and then injects her with a pain reliever, and that's about all they do.
Yeah.
Here, have some Aleve. You're about to die, you know. It's
you know. Take two of these and don't wake up in the morning.
Oh, man.
We are punchy.
I love that Kirk cuts through Spock's techno babble and just orders him to press the right button.
There's more symbols. Can you read them?
I do have an excellent eye for musical notes, Captain. They would seem to indicate that this series of relays activated in their proper spot.
Just press the right button.
That's
push it.
Just like just push the button, Spock. You know, it's like the final scene. Despite all that, the final scene with Miramati is quite touching and it's well done. It's nice acting by both Shatner and Scharf, and it's much more subtle than a lot of the Kirok.
Well, I mean, stuff. He knows that she's dying. She probably knows that she's dying, but, you know, they're still making plans. They're still, you know.
To have many, to bear many, many children. And,
yeah.
And, yeah, and so it's, and I like that there's no tag. There's no tag with them back on the Enterprise, like everything's okay, and it's back to normal. You do see the Enterprise fly away, which, you know, the way that's cut, it's like, did it fly away without the rest of them, or did Kirk stay behind, or, you know, but of course he didn't, but... Because next week they got to act like this, they got to never address this again.
Yeah.
Which, you know, but I mean, if they'd gone back up to the ship and, you know, there'd been some kind of exchange with, you know, Kirk and, you know, Kirk to McCoy and Spock as they, you know, talked about how they bickered back and forth and everything, and you got the do-do-do-do-do-do-do, they would have totally killed it. So I'm glad. Of course, they didn't do that in the City on the Edge of Forever either, you know, which... You know, you just got the, let's get the hell out of here, you know, which, you know, is famous. But despite the you know, us having some fun with it, this episode is one of the standouts in Season 3, partially because the story is pretty daring and that it marries the hero, gives him a child, and then kills both the wife and the kid by the episode's end.
Mm-hmm.
it's not a standard adventure by any means. I mean, this is touch the character of Kirk, even though they don't address it again, ever, that I know of. Probably in books they did, but in no movies or TV shows they ever addressed it again. You know, there is a sweetness to it, a sincerity to it, despite the hamminess and things. But you can definitely see why Kirk would give in to such an easy, peaceful life, you know. Mm-hmm. Especially with a loving, uncomplicated companion like Miramani is. You know, she's, you know, she loves him and that's
she's
it.
She's hot.
She's hot, you know. She frolics around in the woods with him when he's running around shirtless. And
I'm going to get you.
Yeah. Where, you know, whereas, like, we'll get into that in a minute, but, like, you know, Edith Keeler is, she's a different, you know, she's a different type of woman for Kirk. You know, this, well, we'll get into that in a minute.
Now, what I have, this is something that's not in your notes, but it's in my notes. There have been three other instances before of the skies darkening and there being earthquakes and all, right. You know, all of this stuff. So that came down through, what I wanted to know is, were these instances in the past?
Right.
You know, like several generations back that they just heard about? Or were these instances that had been coming up that led up to this specific instance?
Like if it was like a piece of the asteroid that had come by or
something.
That whole thing about them being in an asteroid belt or whatever you want to call it, asteroid alley or whatever you want to call it. Like I said, it's not spelled out very well. And I kind of wonder that too. Were those other instances, is it because Goro's so old he remembered the last time the thing worked? And the medicine man went in there and activated the thing or whatever?
Yeah, see, that's what I don't understand. I mean, that's...
Yeah. Or did it just automatically work and then when it broke down, they had to go in there and fix it?
Yeah, because, are there three instances that were in past generations and they know it because based on their legends and lore? Or is it three instances that were leading up that have been gotten progressively worse?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good point. I don't really know the answer to that.
And they mention that three or four times in the episode.
Yeah. The guest cast is very solid, and as they usually were on Star Trek. Sabrina Scharf is, like we said, she's hot. She's very lovely, short skirt. Rudy Solarish sells the very bitter Salish, and Richard Hale looks like he must have played 100 Indian chiefs on TV and movies before. Scharf actually went on to star in Easy Rider the next year, so she's in that with Jack Nicholson and Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper. She's now a real estate developer, according to IMDb. So, there you go. Rudy Solari popped up on just about every show you can think of into the early 80s, including The Bionic Woman and The Incredible Hulk. Mm-hmm. Now, this one surprised me. Richard Hale did play a lot of Indian chiefs on various westerns of the time, but he also has some interesting genre cred. He played Robert Duvall's father in one of my favorite movies, To Kill a Mockingbird, which, of course, is a classic. And he guested on one of the Thriller episodes that Boris Karloff actually starred in, mm-hmm. where he actually participated in the story, which I've actually got on. That's one of the better episodes on the DVD set I have. Amazingly enough, he played Uncle Gilbert, which is the creature from the Black Lagoon, on The Munsters.
Okay.
He was in the suit. That old guy was Uncle Gilbert. I don't know if they needed somebody small. I don't know. I vaguely recall that episode of The Munsters with Uncle Gilbert. I'm going to have to get on Netflix and find that one. But So he was the creature from the Black Lagoon. So there you go. So add Miramani to the list of women who should have been there with Kirk in Star Trek Generations. Any of the women that, you know, I mean, especially where he's in that wooded, you know, atmosphere.
Yes.
He's in the woods. He's in the trees. He's living a very outdoor life. He's cutting wood. I mean, they could have tied that back to this,
mm-hmm.
and she could have been there.
Mm-hmm.
He could have still had the conveniences of modern life,
right?
Or our modern life, anyway. But you know, it would have almost made more sense for it to be her
because he was married to her.
Yeah, than Edith Keeler, even mm-hmm. though, in my opinion, Kirk, James T. Kirk, fell in love with Edith Keeler because she was, you know,
she challenged his intellect.
She challenged his intellect. She had this foresight,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, she was, you know, so to me, you know.
I bet she, Edith Keeler is a better match for James T. Kirk.
Yeah.
But Miramani was also the love of his id.
Right.
Whereas
yeah.
Edith Keeler was the love of his ego.
Yeah. Or his super ego in mm-hmm. the case of Shatner. yeah. You say sabotage. I say sabotage. Yeah, but I mean, you know, you've got Edith Keeler, you got Miramani, you got Carol Marcus.
Right.
You know, and I think B.B. Beach was still alive at the time. All those, and of course, Joan Collins is still with us and was still acting then.
Mm-hmm.
Any of them could have been there instead of this Phantom Antonia
Even
chick.
Even Ruth from his Academy days.
Yeah, yeah, Ruth. Know? Yeah, that's right, from Shore Leave. Yeah. Any of them would have been better. I mean, that would have helped sell that.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have made it so much more poignant that Kirk left them behind
mm-hmm.
to go, you know, help Picard because he can't do nothing on his own. but, you know, I always liked this one. I don't know if it was because just, you know, I think because, you know, the elements of it just jump out at you. It stands out. I like Westerns anyway, you know, and, you know, see Kirk in buckskins, you know.
Yeah.
So it's cool. So what did you think of it?
Well, I thought it was a great episode, especially for us to do now. And, I mean, this is just something that I'm going to say, but this past Wednesday, Christopher and I celebrated 20 years of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I've been putting up with him for 20 years. and 5 years before that.
yes. Yeah, so this was a good episode to discuss.
Yeah, we were in a lovey-dovey mood, so, you know.
Yeah, so where Kirk gets married was a good one to discuss this week. And actually, we usually do, you know, we started out Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
The Valentine's theme. And then last year for our first year anniversary, we did comic book couples in our first episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did the marriage of those couples, some of them, last year. But, you know, it's about a month early, but, you know.
Yeah.
it's close to Valentine's Day anyway, so we're getting close. You see Valentine's Day stuff at Walmart. And
hell, you saw it December 26th.
Yeah, you did.
I mean, seriously.
You really did, yeah. So, next time, you want to do what you were talking about doing next time?
Oh, I don't know. Let's wait and surprise them, because I'm not sure.
Okay. So, we've got some, you know, we're getting close to episode 50. This is episode 47. We've actually got something special planned for episode 50, working out all the details. I think you'll like it. We've got some, you know, fun stuff planned. You know, our home life is getting stabilized again, hopefully. Seems to be. So we should be in good shape. But I had a lot of fun talking about this, and,
mm-hmm.
and I hope you guys had a lot of fun listening. Until then, we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com. Comments can be left at our blog at supermatescomic.blogspot.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermage Podcast. Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
This is the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. Age of Aquarius. Aquarius! Aquarius! Harmony and understanding. Sympathy and trust abounding. No more falsehoods and derisions. Golden living, dream of visions. Mystic crystal revelations. And the mind's true liberation. Aquarius. Aquarius.